time for the Israel Report. Today we're speaking to Knaan Lidor, journalist for the JNS and award-winning journalist, actually. Knaan, it's been way too long. I'm really glad we're chatting. Thank you for being with me on the Home Run.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I was a bit indisposed in Kazakhstan with Israel's president visiting Astana, the Kazakh capital, which is a remarkable place and a remarkable country.
Oh my goodness me. I saw that was one of the issues we were going to talk about today. I didn't for 1 minute think that you were on a delegation there. I've been to Mongolia, which is right next door. I've never seen empty steppes and empty land, the extent to which I saw there. I'm imagining Kazakhstan is pretty much a repeat.
Well, I imagine the same, but I don't know how Mongolia is like, but when I got there, it was the Dubai of Central Asia.
You're
it's
joking.
A massive concrete and glass new capital, just built on the marshes, the same way that Brasilia and Brazil was built out of nothing in a few decades. This city, Astana, is astonishing, and it just imbued with the concepts of innovation. It has an innovation museum, which is very conceptual, with they're devoted to AI, but really all the screens are interactive. It's something difficult to describe, and that was also the impetus for the visit. Kazakhstan really wants in on two things: Israeli innovation and Israeli weapons. And maybe also Israeli connections with America. And that was kind of the background to this visit.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. Tell me just a little bit more, because my knowledge of Kazakhstan is zero. Are we talking an ex-Soviet republic? Are we talking a Muslim republic that, despite the fact there's a war and a Gaza issue, is ready to reach out to Israel? Is that what you're telling me?
Pretty much. It's also the largest country in the world, four times the size of Texas. It's enormous, and it has just astonishingly large mineral resources, rare earths, also oil. And so it also has the interest of siding with the West. It wants to break away from that club in Central Asia of Turkmenistan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. It wants a little something more. It's a country of just 20 million people. And that's where Israel comes in. Israel, with its connections to the U.S., Israel, with its innovation and cyber abilities, that is seen by the president, the authoritarian president Tokayev, as a stepping stone for his country, for his plans for his country. He's a 72-year-old former Soviet official who was charting a new course for his country. And part of that was joining the Abraham Accords in November. And that's a very tricky position for Kazakhstan because, as you mentioned, it has a Muslim majority. And so we saw earlier in other Muslim majority countries that siding with Israel has an internal price. And these are already authoritarian regimes with internal problems. They don't necessarily want to add Israel to the list of grievances of the local population. But so far, Kazakhstan is doing a pretty good job at it. We came there and the whole highway was just plastered with Israeli flags.
Wow.
This was no low-key visit.
Wow.
There was a marching band. Everybody knew that the Israeli president was in town because they blocked the entire highway, and in 150 intervals there were cops and security blocking people from even approaching. We didn't see, of course, a hint of a protest. And maybe more importantly, when Tokayev spoke, he didn't even mention Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iran. Didn't even mention it. He just said, we're for stability. That's why we joined the Abraham Accords. And that's part of the reason Israel is pivoting eastward. These are environments with very clear agendas. They know what they want. And as long as they get it, they're happy. And that's a very different arena from what Israel is experiencing in Western Europe, in also part of the Anglo-speaking world, where concessions to Israel's Arab and Muslim enemies are required to make bilateral headway. So we're seeing it also with India The Prophet Modi came to Israel just in February for the second time already, and it's just a great diplomatic realignment for Israel.
And important from a geopolitical perspective, because it seems like Israel's future is east. It is interesting that when one goes to Mongolia, getting a visa is a pain in the neck of note. And if you're an Israeli, you literally just waltz in. It is the easiest thing in the world for Israeli. That I think it's visa-free for Israelis. It's absolutely insane. And what's even more insane, I'm sorry, I'm just quite, because I've just been to that part of the world and it's quite fresh. If you look at the map, Dagestan, which is where there was almost a pogrom at the airport, which is a province of Russia, during the Gaza war, it's literally just across the border. So these people are taking very brave stances, being as supportive and friendly with Israel as they are being. So fascinating you've been there. Absolutely fascinating. Let's bring it back to Europe. I know it's not Israel, but I don't think we can have an Israel report and not talk about the Golders Green incident today. This coming after the ambulances were set fire to, attempted arson of synagogues. Not good things happening in the UK, Knan.
Shocking. We use that word way too often, but just to look at the footage that came on X today from the incident in Golders Green, shocking in every way, and I'll explain what I mean. Shocking that this man was able to run streets, whole streets, trying to butcher Jews with a large knife. Shocking that he was apprehended not by police, by the Shomrim. Shocking that the victims were treated not by ambulance of the London Rescue Service, but by the Hatzolah Haredi Service. And shocking that the man was so bent on killing Jews that police had to kick him in the head just to get him to let go of the knife. A truly remarkable breakdown of order in on so many levels, because this is after the Metropolitan Police's beefed up presence in Golders Green and a few other northern London neighborhoods with large Jewish populations, and yet they somehow failed to pick up on this guy. Here in Israel, of course, we have different techniques that help mostly capture these assailants even before they commit the deed. But this was a total breakdown of all those layers of security and even emergency response. And it just kind of illustrates the feeling among so many British Jews that they are on their own. They are back in the ghetto and they need to deal with the Cossacks who are getting in. It's just that terrible rewind of history to so many people, and I spoke to some of them on the phone today, and the response from Israel to this is also remarkable. The foreign ministry said that Keir Starmer's words are not enough, we need to see
empty
action.
Yeah.
That's not usually the kind of language that they use. And we saw Israel's minister for Aliyah, for Klita, for immigrant absorption, speaking about how Britain is becoming unbearably unsafe for Jews, kind of hinting, come home to Israel. And we are seeing big increase in Aliyah stats. 2025 was the highest on record, with already 870, kind of touching on the 1,000 mark, which is double what we're seeing in normal years. These are, of course, not large numbers. London, the UK has about 300,000 Jews, but it does indicate a trend, and we're seeing more and more people come out and say that this is the beginning of the end of British Jewry.
I'm astounded by these continuing attacks. I just would have, you know, I understand it. We've spoken, you've had personal experience of Dutch Jews, Holland, the pogroms with the canals in Amsterdam. We've had that discussion, but they're a small community. The Jewish community in the UK is big, it's large, it's powerful. The fact that they can absolutely do nothing about this and sit there powerless just blows me away. I obviously have overestimated the strength that I thought they had.
Well, this is the community that, of course, blocked the the Nazi marches in the 1930s on Cable Street. This is a very, like you said, a very powerful community with head knockers, which is something that maybe only only the French and the British communities have in Europe, and yet it's being cowed, it's being hemmed in by the government, but also by its own helplessness and perhaps disbelief in its future. We've begun seeing these voices coming from people like Simon Sharma questioning the future of British Jewry. This was a very new phenomenon. This is just 5 years ago. And this mental state could also explain why they are powerless to stop this calamity that's unfolding on them.
And in some way, this is personal because we've all got friends and family in the United Kingdom. We all know Hendon and Golders Green. We've all walked on that high street. This is somehow very personal. We know the streets of London.
But it's even more than that. It's personal for the entire world, because Britain is, of course, the seed of Western civilization. That's how it's seen. Yeah. And if this can happen in the UK, it can and will happen anywhere. And that's why all of Europe's Jews are now looking to see what happens in Britain, this shining light tower of yesteryear, with great concern.
I'm looking at the time. It's 5:56. I've got a hard stop at 6, but let's talk the time out, Kanaan, if you don't mind. Swiss Parliament votes against recognizing Palestinian state. Tell me the backstory there.
Well, this was an initiative by the Canton of Geneva. They have, of course, their large immigrant population there to make them route of getting the government to recognize Palestinian statehood. They tried this in last year with the Senate. The Senate said no, and then they brought it to the lower house in Switzerland. They have even powers. And that failed too, and that shows that, especially in the German-speaking countries of Europe, there is still a sort of sobriety about immigration, especially in Switzerland, especially in Austria. We're also seeing it in Denmark. So not all is lost, and this is the sign of, for now, the Nordic and some Nordic and some German-speaking countries saying, no, enough of this insanity, this tokenism, the symbolism bleeds down to our streets in the end, and this doesn't remain on the external diplomatic level. This has internal consequences, and those are the voices that are coming from the moderate right and the center and saying, no, this has gone far enough. We're not feeding the pro-Palestinian beast any longer.
I want to take you to Israel now, where apparently the Haredi anti-draft protesters are blocking the main entrance to Jerusalem. As we speak, police are working to disperse them. It seems to me that they are taking kind of binary position here, like it's all or nothing. There doesn't seem to be any attempt to want to compromise on this issue at all.
On the horizon, we have election, of course, and the Haredi leadership needs to flex its muscles to show to Netanyahu that it won't bow down, but it can't push too hard, because if the coalition caves, if it topples, then the alternative to Netanyahu is probably going to be less friendly to Haredim. And so I would say that these protests right now, they're low intensity. We know how mad protests by Haredim look like. It's 500,000 people on the street. It's not couple of 100 blocking a junction. So I don't think we're there yet in terms of a total approach and total intransigence. It's more of a signaling while trying to maintain the status quo for now. That's my reading, at least.
That is fascinating. It's also interesting how the opponents of the Haredi movement are also posturing at the moment. I just read a article on Avigdor Lieberman's Facebook post a few moments ago, talking about his manifesto and him saying, you know, on my watch, they won't be able to vote for the Knesset. They won't be able to apply for jobs in state or local authorities, etc., etc., etc. It seems like everybody's digging in. Are you saying this is pre-election ploys that's going on?
Yeah, this is appealing to the base, and it's working both ways. It's polarizing, literally. Lieberman is trying to sound tough to his base, while his threats are pushing Haredim more closer to their base and to the right-wing government. And so it's kind of it's preventing the change that Lieberman is trying to promote, this extremist rhetoric. What needs to happen for change is pragmatic solutions, not more sanctions, but incremental work with some pressure, of course, and some enforcement that the Netanyahu government right now is not applying. So there needs to be a middle ground, but certainly trying to deprive, 20% of the population here of basic rights is not a serious strategy.
Kanaan, I'm out of time. Thank you, as always. It was a pleasure talking to you again. Glad you're back from Kazakhstan. I've got 10 seconds to go until news. Quick thank you to Senna. Quick thank you to Craig. And most of all, a thank you to you for being with me here on The Home Run. Come back. We'll do it all over again tomorrow.